Welcome to the first podcast, one that's on the first half of Candide, or Optimism, written by Voltaire. By now, you've already looked at the website information about Voltaire. Perhaps you've even seen Voltaire and Optimism, like which eventually you're going to have to look through. We discussed, those present the idea that this is a text that Voltaire created in order to respond to the Lisbon earthquake, where he was asking questions that we call a theodicy. Those three fundamental philosophical questions. If God is great, and if God is good, and evil exists, how do you hold all three of all those things in your mind at the same time? One of them has to give. And so Candide is going to present us with kind of a series of tragedies that he tells us about in a pretty comical way, deliberately. Because he's not interested in kind of narrative realism. What he wants to do is deliberately kind of exaggerate or hyperbolize the events that occur, right? Characters that should have been dead a half dozen times in this text keep coming back to life. And characters that we are really rooting for, that we want to live, end up dying. In fact, we'll talk about that once we see the character of Martin. So we start with Candide, with the Baron Thunder ten Tronc, right? He's the Baron's nephew because he's a child born out of wedlock to the Baron's sister, which means that in Europe at the time, he can't prove his heritage, he can't prove his lineage, and so he's essentially persona non grata, that he has no way to really inherit any land or fortune, no way to really make his way in the world. His uncle, the Baron, kindly took him in, and we get an idea of just how, you know, Voltaire is going to lampoon this kind of the petty bourgeois that we have here, where he talks about that Baron being one of the most mighty lords of Westphalia, because for the simple reason that his castle had doors and windows, and the Baroness was obviously a great woman because she weighed about 350 pounds. He had a cousin, the young Baron, whom he's known as, and then another cousin who's going to be really important to this text, Kunigunda, a girl, let's say that eventually they grow to like, lust, and maybe even love one another. She's a ruddy-cheeked girl, as our text says, fresh, plump, and desirable. Voltaire's project in all of this was he wants to poke fun at nationalism. He wants to criticize religious intolerance. He wants to especially destroy this idea of philosophical optimism that somehow when these great tragedies occur in the world, we just can't say, oh, all is for the best and the best of all possible worlds. No, sometimes tragedies are just tragedies. So in chapter one, we get the whole setup and everything, and we see that the one other person in that household, besides the people I've just mentioned, is the tutor, the household tutor named Pangloss, who gives instruction, Voltaire tells us, in metaphysico-theologico-cosmolunigology, right? A deliberately kind of nonsensical term to match, let's face it, Pangloss's nonsensical take on the world. There can't be an effect without a cause. All right, that's Aristotle. And can't be, and that the best of all possible worlds was the Baron's castle. Well, you know, it did have doors and windows, but I'm thinking that there were probably better places around. At the kind of the tail end of the chapter, we see that Candide, a young naive boy, let's call him 13, 14 years old, right, sees, he's kind of worships Pangloss, and Miss Cunegunda, his cousin, is the one who sees Pangloss and the maid. She's unnamed here, but she'll be named later on in the text. Sees them in the bushes, basically, and you can tell what they're doing. They're having sex. But being that Pangloss is a philosopher, and that's what he's teaching the children of the household, right, Cunegunda watches breathlessly the repeated experiments, the philosophical experiments. She saw clearly the doctor's sufficient reason, observed both cause and effect, and returned to the house in a distracted and pensive frame of mind, hoping that she could try out some of these experiments with her cousin, Candide. Well, Candide, right, 13, 14-year-old boy, he's up for this. Right? He really is kind of naive and doesn't know what's going on. In fact, this is a great example of just how naive Candide is. He's really not aware of what's going on. You know, and you'd think if you're going to go make out with your cousin, you might do it someplace private, but no, Kunigunda grabs him behind, like, this little screen in the dining room while everybody's at dinner. Well, things don't go well. The screen falls down, the Baron finds them, and Candide is kicked out. And thus begins his journey from kind of this little embryonic state, from kind of the shelter of this home of the Baron's house, all the way across Europe. It's going to take him all the way to the New World, and then bring him back across Europe again, and get out of Europe on the other side, and ends up the text in Turkey, right? So Candide has no idea where he's going, no idea what he's going to do, but he happens upon two military recruiters who decide that Candide would be awesome for their army. Not just because he's willing, and not because he knows how to fight, not because he knows much of what's going on, but because he happens to be the right height and the right hair color. This is kind of a knock. In fact, the term Bulgars here, the Bulgars and the Abares, are the two warring factions here, the warring countries we're going to see. The term Bulgars is Voltaire's dig at Frederick the Great. Now, as you saw in the biographical web information, kings of Europe kind of vied for Voltaire to come live at their court, and he made his way around. He spent time in Prussia, in England, of course, in France. He was kicked out of France, right? If you looked at that, biographical information. Frederick the Great was a great, great military leader. He gave us really lots of modern military strategies that we still use. The idea of the close order drill, the idea of advanced formations, things like that. That's all Frederick the Great. But the problem was he was kind of a martinet as well. He didn't treat his people very well, and Voltaire really kind of had a civilizing effect on him, showing the man how to be a bit more human, how to be a better king. They did not part on good terms because Voltaire just probably told Frederick one too many times about how he was being inhuman or inhumane. And so this dig of Frederick the Great and worried about the soldier sizes is Frederick had entire regiments composed of, you know, recruits of the exact same height, because he treated them kind of like toy soldiers almost, the way he would teach them to walk, teach them to do the close order drills. And the term Bulgar itself is deliberately supposed to remind you of buggery, right? Forced sex with young boys. The term gets associated with most commonly Navy ships, especially the British Navy. It just gets tossed about by the other European nations. But here's one of its uses where Candide is making this kind of laughing up his sleeve joke at the expense of Frederick. And so Frederick's army here is installed. Candide joins it, but what he really finds out is, you know, the war is kind of pointless. We don't really know what the war is going on with. Candide tries to escape. He figures that I'm just going to keep on walking, right? Oh, that won't go. That won't do, right? You're the bulwark. You're the support. You're the defender, right? Didn't understand what he was doing because he's very naive. So he just leaves, which is, of course, against military law, and he's made to run the gauntlet. Running the gauntlet, as it says, right, he had to run the gauntlet 36 times. Every man in the regiment lines up, and they all get to take a swat at him as he runs between them. 36 times, and then endured two floggings. By any kind of common sense of realism, the guy should be dead, but he's not. Instead, the king shows up, has this special ointment, and boom, he's saved, right? A worthy surgeon cured Candide in 3 weeks with the ointments prescribed. Right? Has a bit of skin back and walked when the king of the Bulgars went to war with the king of the Abares. He goes to war with the king of the Ivares, and what we see in chapter 3 is that both kings think they've won this war, right? They're both offering Te Deums, hymns of praise, but Candide doesn't see that, because he comes upon, as we see, and this is, Voltaire wants to rub our face in this. What we see from this is, you know, this Ivare village, which the Bulgars had burned in strict accordance with the laws of war. Old men, stunned from beatings, watched the last agonies of their butchered wives, who still clutched their infants to their bleeding breasts. Disemboweled girls, who had first been raped, breathed their last. Other bodies, half scorched in the flames, begged to be killed. Scattered brains and severed limbs all over the ground. And it's not just the Bulgars doing this, it's the Ivares, right? The exact same village goes on back and forth. And so what we find out is the only real winner is both sides of the military, right? The kind of the military-industrial complex, if Voltaire had that terminology. But the losers are always the non-combatants. And what's interesting here is the way Voltaire is also going to play with kind of narrative focus. He spends almost a paragraph describing just kind of that first glance at this town that has been suffered these atrocities. But later, he's going to walk practically halfway across Europe, and it's just going to take a sentence. Right? Something that would obviously take weeks, if not months, to do. But that's not, you know, Voltaire's not concerned with realism. He wants to drive us from incident to incident so that we can see certain things. And in fact, the next big thing he's going to talk about here is, right, when Voltaire arrives in the Low Countries, right, countries known for their religious fervor, right, for their embrace of the Protestant Reformation. And Candide stands there starving in front of a street preacher who is talking about charity, who's talking about loving one's neighbor. And he asks him, after he's done listening for an hour, asks him just for a piece of bread. And what the street preacher tells him is interesting. It tells him, nope. Do you think the Pope is the Antichrist? And Candide says, well, you know, I never really thought about it. Right? Kind of one of the fundamental tenets of the early Reformation was, of course, right, a denial of the apostolic succession in Rome. Right? So the Pope is the Antichrist. I haven't thought about it, said Candide. Well, then you're not on my side. You don't deserve any bread. Away with you, you rascal, you rogue. Never come near me as long as you live. What happened to that hour-long sermon on love and treating your neighbor well and things like that? In fact, the preacher's wife then ends up literally dumping a bucket of feces on top of Candide's head, which was, unfortunately, a far too common occurrence during the rapid urbanization when there's no kind of municipal plumbing or anything. Right? People would dump their chamber pots out the windows and yell, you know, just dump it into the street. They yell out, Garde Louis, which becomes, when the British hear that, Garde Louis, look out below, kind of basically, everybody pay attention, look out, something comes flying. Explains why women walk on the inside when we walk on sidewalks, because men want to protect the finery of the women's clothing and protect them from literally getting shit dumped on them. And it explains also why the British especially, when they heard Garde Louis, what they heard was Garde Loo. So the British slang for the bathroom is the loo. After this event, right, here comes a man who's going to help him out. A man who had never been baptized, a good Anabaptist named Jacques, right? Now, Anabaptists are an interesting group. They're a religious group. We could call them Christian. In fact, we could call them kind of primitive Christians. They are they don't believe in being baptized. They believe that just as a human, you are a member of their community. They hold all goods and all property in common, and everybody works for the common good. This is going to be a big theme. We're going to see this in El Dorado, and we're going to see this in Turkey as well. This idea that everybody works for the common good. And the way, right, after having been so terribly treated by the street preacher, here's this guy whom any good, decent, institutional religionist hates, loathes in Europe at the time, who comes in, literally binds Candide's wounds, takes him home with him, washed him off, gave him bread and beer, gave him money, undertook to give him a job. This might sound familiar to you, right? Maybe from the Bible. It's essentially the parable of the Good Samaritan. Here's this guy who does the good, right? And the question Jesus asks in the Bible is, who then treated this man as a brother? After this, Candide again miraculously recovers. He meets a beggar the next day. Oh, it turns out to be Pangloss. Well, now we've got the old gang's getting back together. Pangloss catches him up on what's going on, right? Candide is more or less heartbroken because he thinks Cunegonde is dead. We see Pangloss, who is suffering advanced venereal disease, advanced sexually transmitted disease that he got from the maid Paquette that time when Cunegonde saw them in the bushes. In fact, his nose is falling off. Now, granted, this is brought up and this is kind of a joke, and he makes a couple of digs here, but the STD that should kill Pangloss soon, given its advanced stage that we see here, is kind of never mentioned again in the rest of the text. So here comes Pangloss, and of course Jacques the Anabaptist takes Pangloss in as well. They end up on a ship headed to Portugal, something to do about his work, something to do about Jacques' work, right? He's going to take these two guys along. And they are in the harbor in Lisbon when the great earthquake of 1755 hits. Soldiers are fearing for their lives. Sailors are fearing for their lives, right? People are thrown overboard. Jacques jumps in, tries to save somebody, and ends up drowning. But, you know, you've already seen Candide come back to life once here. You've already seen Pangloss, you know, appears to be hale and healthy, just, you know, half a page after he looks like he's dying of syphilis. Surely Jacques is going to come back. But no, this is one of the first great ironies of the text. Jacques isn't going to come back. Jacques's the only, well, I don't want to spoil it and tell you that he's the only decent person in this text, but of the minor characters, yes, he is the only kind of exemplary, humanely decent person. And yet, he's the only one who dies. Candide's cousin, the young Baron, oh, a truly kind of nasty, obnoxious, offensively prideful man, is killed at least three times in this text, but never dies. Eventually ends up being sold on a slave ship as Candide gets his revenge. Now, here's Jacques dead, Candide and Pangloss in Lisbon. The Lisbonites think that this great earthquake is, oh, it's a sign of God's displeasure, so we must perform what they call an auto de fe, right, an act of faith. And how they're going to do it? Not through penitence, not through individual sacrifice, but through communal sacrifice. And communal sacrifice is really kind of scary here. They're going to execute a bunch of people, right? It's like, I don't know, Polynesian primitives throwing virgins in to please the volcano god so it doesn't erupt. This certainly is not a Christian thing, and let's face it, every country in Europe at this time considered itself a Christian place. So they're going to kill, look who the Lisbonites are going to kill. They're going to kill somebody they thought was a Jew, who just doesn't like bacon, which I know is weird, because everybody loves bacon, but they're going to kill a couple of, nobody, they're not actually killing any Lisbonites. They're going to kill Pangloss, they're going to kill Candide, they're going to kill somebody who may have eaten sausage, some people they might accuse of being like a hidden Jew, those crypto-Jews as they're there. And just at the moment of death, right, just as they're ready to perform the auto de fe, here comes this old woman up to save their lives. Turns out, she's sent from, oh, look, she's still alive, Cunegonde, right? Cunegonde, who has been, and yet another example of religious hypocrisy, Cunegonde, who is being shared as the mistress from the Grand Inquisitor, right? And if you don't know what the Inquisition is, look it up. Don't just satisfy yourself with the Monty Python, right? No one expects the Spanish Inquisition. Look it up and see what people did in the name of religion. They're spared. Cunegunda is, because Cunegunda is, let's say she has access to power because she shared as a mistress by the Grand Inquisitor and Don Issachar, right? They're killing Jews because European anti-Semitism is huge at this time. But the Grand Inquisitor, the one who's probably one of the greatest anti-Semites, is willing to share his mistress, right, against, of course, his vows of celibacy, with a Jewish moneylender or money changer. Cunegunda tells her story for a few chapters, right? And, you know, you see that the Grand Inquisitor basically has worse morals than almost anyone else in the story. And then we get a couple chapters of the old woman's story. Lots of cannibalism happening here, right? And, oh, let's just make sure, okay, we've talked about the hypocrisy of Protestants. Now we talked about the hypocrisy of Roman Catholics. And now we're going to talk about the hypocrisy of Muslims as well, right? And the hypocrisy of Jews. Certainly we're going to see it all, right? All institutional religions are carried out like this. By chapter 13, they're on their way out of Europe and headed to South America. And that is where we'll pick up with the next podcast for Candide.